All rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States v. Major Paul D. Voorhees, ACM 38836. Today we consider two issues during oral arguments. They are, first, whether the military judge erred when she concluded that Military Rule of Evidence 412 did not prohibit the alleged victim from testifying over defense objection about childhood sexual abuse suffered by the alleged victim when the testimony was offered by the government to explain the alleged victim's behavior during the charged offenses. Second, whether the military judge abused her discretion when, after defense counsel's closing argument, she sua sponte instructed the members that they may not assume or presume that because the government did not present some evidence, that the evidence must have been detrimental to its case. Appellate counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel for the government. Oh, my God. Why didn't you say something? That was Major Voorhees' reaction on the pretext call when the complaining witness told him that she didn't want it to happen. You can listen to it for yourselves. It's Prosecution Exhibit 5. There's a recording on a CD as well as a PowerPoint transcript of the call. And I know you've read it already, but call court's attention to that. Oh, my God, why didn't you say something? The total shock in his voice is very important in this case because this case is all about whether this young woman consented to this long and drawn-out series of sexual activity that took place over approximately 2 hours on the night in question. And so she admitted during her testimony that she didn't tell him to stop, she didn't get up and leave, didn't ask him to leave. But let's forget about what she didn't do. Let's talk about what she did do. She did let him give her a nude massage, which she told OSI she was okay with that. She did engage in vaginal sexual intercourse with him. And when it was over, they sat around, laid around in the bed and talked and watched TV for 20 or 30 minutes. And then the sexual activity started up again with oral sex, vaginal sex. And then they laid around again until it was time to go to breakfast. That's all very important, Your Honors, because the only evidence of non-consent, the only evidence that she didn't actually consent to this sexual activity was her testimony that because she was sexually abused as a child, she was saying no in her head. And so the military judge's ruling that this testimony was admissible is crucial to this case. It's crucial and it's erroneous. And before we get into why it's erroneous, I need to break it down. There's actually two components to the military judge's ruling. The first component is that the complainant's testimony was admissible about her childhood abuse. But the second component of the ruling is very important as well. She also ruled that Major Voorhees' knowledge of the abuse or lack of knowledge was not relevant. And with all due respect, we submit that both of those prongs of the ruling are completely erroneous and that because of it, Major Voorhees did not get a fair trial. We're asking you to set aside the findings in the sentence. So, first and foremost, before we get to 412, it's very important to realize from our perspective, and I think from a reasonable perspective, this evidence about her being abused as a child was completely irrelevant under MRE 401. And you don't even get to 412 until you cross over the 401 threshold. Why is it relevant? The government said it was relevant to explain why she acted the way she did with Major Voorhees. And our position, quite frankly, is maybe if she acted the same way during her childhood experience that she did with Major Voorhees, there would be some probative value. But the evidence is uncontradicted, if I may say so, that she didn't behave the same way when she was a child, when she was being terribly, horribly abused by someone who was supposed to take care of her. I feel terrible that this happened to her.
Counsel, I have a question just regarding your proposed way that the military judge should analyze it, which is the first question is whether this is relevant.
Yes.
And then if it's relevant, you apply MRE 412. Why would a better way to approach this not be to first apply 412, and then if it passes 412, then you have to get into whether it is relevant and whether or not it comes in under MRE 412?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and in all candor, I don't think it matters which one you do first. I think that both MRE 401 and 412 prohibit the admission of the evidence. But I'm trying to point out just from a logical standpoint why this evidence wasn't even relevant to start with. But we do go through the 412 analysis because that's the premise that the parties were under at the time of the trial. So clearly 412 is relevant to this discussion. We think it keeps it out. But back to the relevance. It's really important to note that not only the complaining witness's behavior at the time of the abuse versus the time of the events with Major Voorhees, not only was her behavior different, but the behavior of the other participant, the behavior of the abusive, cruel foster father that raped her was different than the way she described her perception of Major Voorhees' conduct on the night in question. Her foster father was abusing her, hurting her, mean to her. She described Major Voorhees as being gentle, non-threatening, not forceful, not violent. In fact, she described him as being nurturing. So the context in which these acts occurred is completely dissimilar, and therefore there's no logical relevance. But even if you conclude that it has some relevance, then a necessary corollary to that is that it's only relevant to the extent that Major Voorhees knew about it. Because the government's theory was, well, explain how she acted on that night, and because he knew about it, he preyed on her.
Let me ask you this. Is it relevant, counsel, what the alleged victim was thinking about whether or not she wanted something to happen? Is that a relevant consideration for the members in determining whether she consented, what she was actually thinking?
I honestly don't think so, because the only way it could possibly be relevant is if there was some other evidence in conjunction with that. In other words, if she expressed that thought. And just thinking no in her head is not sufficient, especially when she does all these other affirmative things, kissing him passionately, moaning in pleasure. She admitted during her testimony, she enjoyed the experience. That is the message that Major Voorhees received. He didn't get the message in her head if she had it. And again, we take issue with the credibility of that testimony, quite frankly. The fact that she was enjoying this experience, and this was a long, drawn-out thing, it was totally dissimilar to the, I laid there passively so it would be over with quicker when I was being abused as a child. That's not what happened here. She didn't lay here passively so that Major Voorhees would hurry up and finish. He had sex with her. 20, 30 minutes of chit-chat later, he starts kissing her. She kisses him back. It's not like he's kissing her. They were kissing each other passionately. Then they have sex again, oral sex and then vaginal sex. So there were a lot of opportunities for it to be over. The fact that she was thinking that in her head, if she was, I don't think has any relevance, because if she's doing all these things and sending this message to Major Voorhees, he got the message that I think a reasonable person would receive, is that she was actually consenting.
All right, Nick, and just to be clear, make sure I understand your position, though. Mistake of fact is the consent is a defense in this case, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the government had to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt, correct?
Yes, sir.
They had the burden. So when you talk in terms of what the appellant thought or what he was receiving, don't you agree that does not go to the issue of whether she actually consented, but whether he reasonably had a mistake of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with you. Okay. All I'm saying is I'm not willing to concede. I know I don't really need to do this, but I'm really not willing to concede that she was actually not consenting. I think she was consenting, and I think that he had an honest and reasonable mistake of fact that she was consenting, and under either theory, he should have been acquitted. The judge's ruling is just completely backwards. She says that the abuse is relevant, but his knowledge or lack of knowledge is not relevant, and those two have to stand or fall together, in our opinion. Let's get to the 412. Our contention, Your Honors, is that this sexual activity, granted it was non-consensual on her part, the sexual activity that she engaged in when she was a child falls squarely within the strictures of MRE 412. It is sexual behavior other than the charged offense, and So the controlling case law from the Court of Appeals from the Armed Forces, specifically Banker and Gaddis, make it very clear that MRE 412 is a rule of exclusion, that the proponent of the evidence has a burden of proving its admissibility, and that if it doesn't fall within one of the three enumerated exceptions, it doesn't come in. And the privacy interest of the complaining witness is not the determining factor, as the government would have you believe. In fact, Gaddis says that if the evidence is admissible, it comes in regardless of how embarrassing it is to the complaining witness. And if, on the other side, if it's not admissible, if it doesn't come in under one of the exceptions, it doesn't matter that there's only a minimal intrusion on her privacy. So controlling case law, I think, limits the applicability of her privacy interests. And again, Banker says, that, and the following cases that follow Banker say, that this rule applies to both parties. This is not a rule that only applies to the defense when the defense wants to put in evidence. There's not a lot of cases, but there are cases where the government tries to put in evidence under 412, and a 412 analysis is done. Same thing with assault of offenses. There's a lot of, if you shepherdize Banker, you'll see a bunch of cases that talk about when either the defense or the government tries to put in evidence of some prior assault of offense, a rape or child abuse. They still do a 412 analysis. So the government's position that 412 doesn't apply because A, the prior event was not consensual, or B, because the accused doesn't have standing, are just foreclosed by controlling case law that says it applies to both parties and consent is not an issue.
Counsel, let me ask you one specific question. MRE 412, when we talk about what it covers, it says that it prohibits evidence offered to prove that any alleged victim engaged in other sexual behavior. So the military judge in this case made a determination or made a finding that the victim in this case, or the alleged victim in this case, that she was a victim of child sexual abuse, that she was not actually engaging in any sexual behavior. Why? I want to focus you specifically on the engaged in. It seems as though engaged in potentially could mean some type of active involvement with, the victim being actively involved with. And you earlier talked in terms of that prior child sexual abuse as being a very passive thing. She was just laying there. So isn't that some information that suggests that she was not actually engaging in the sexual behavior that was happening to her?
I think that's a fair question, Hunter, and I think the answer's been provided by courts all across the country, and they've said no. And I'll give you an example. The Michigan case that I cited to you in my motion for supplemental authority, to cite supplemental authority, talks about conduct or behavior as including both volitional and non-volitional acts. And the reason for that is that even if it's something being done to you, you're still behaving or acting or engaging in conduct. And to illustrate that, the defense of duress, for example. Someone who says, I did this act, but I didn't do it voluntarily because I was under the threat of some sort of harm to myself or some our loved one, impending death. The person's still engaged in the conduct, even though it's legally justifiable. It doesn't mean he didn't engage in the conduct. And so that was that Michigan judge's explanation of why conduct or behavior includes both consensual and non-consensual. And again, as I mentioned, there are a plethora of cases, most of them unreported, so I didn't cite them to the court, but they all cite Banker. They talk about child sexual abuse specifically, and they apply 412 analysis. So if the court's theory is correct that one doesn't engage when one is in conduct, when one is a victim of child sexual abuse, then a 412 analysis would never be done because the rule just wouldn't apply. Right? A military judge could say, well, this is non-consensual assaultive behavior. You didn't engage in the conduct, so we're not going to even look at 412. But that's not what happens. The cases uniformly apply a 412 analysis, even when it's child sexual abuse at issue.
Let me provide a scenario to you. I want to make sure I understand how your interpretation of this rule would apply to this scenario. The overly sexualized behavior of a minor. So you've got a situation, a circumstance where this minor child is acting out maybe against a sister, over-sexualized stuff, and maybe a stepfather or someone else has been prosecuted for sexually abusing that minor. Would testimony regarding that overly sexualized behavior of the minor to other people, would that be barred by MRE 412 because it's sexual behavior? In other words, actually, would 412 come into play? Would that be a circumstance where that would be engaging in sexual behavior.
I think, Your Honor. I think that if she's engaging in behavior that is of a sexual nature, the courts say that it doesn't have to be sexual intercourse. It could be kissing. It could be viewing pornography. There's a wider range of activity that's covered by the definition of sexual behavior besides just sexual intercourse. So, yes, I believe that if the witness was engaging in over-sexualized behavior, then MRE 412 would apply, and the judge would have to do an analysis. I'm not saying it would come in or not come in, but I think then the analysis has to be done.
All right, if it applied, if you apply the MRE 412, how would that come in? If you're saying that is sexual behavior and none of the exceptions apply, how would that evidence ever come in under MRE 412?
I'm not sure that it would, Your Honor, and that's a fair question, and it goes to the heart of, I think, what the judge's mistake was in this case. I think, again, with respect, I think she applied a statute that she wanted to be in effect, not the statute that is in effect. We don't look at legislative history. We don't look at drafter's analysis. We don't look at any of that if the words of the statute, or in this case the rule, are clear and unambiguous. And again, if the president wants to change the rule and make it broader and provide an exception for the government, for example, like it's okay if the government wants to put it in for this particular justification, the president's free to do that. But we have to apply the rule as it's written today, not what we'd like the rule to be for the government. So I agree that there will be, on purpose, they're trying to limit. It's a rule of exclusion. They don't want evidence of complaining witnesses' sexual behavior or predisposition come into evidence. It's only a few rare situations where it's relevant and should come in. So finally, to wrap up on the 412, I mean, 401 bars it, 412 bars it, and certainly 403 bars it. 403, it's unduly prejudicial. I'm sorry, but thank you. And it's noteworthy that the military judge's rulings she specifically told the trial counsel, you may not argue that because Major Voorhees knew about this, he preyed on her. But what does the trial counsel do in his closing argument at page 407? He does exactly that. He says, well, perhaps Major Voorhees knew of this tragic past and took advantage of her. And that's exactly what he did. And there was a lot of prejudice from that. There was no other evidence of non-consent or no convincing evidence of non-consent. And you have to look at the sympathy factor. You have this woman who's talking about being repeatedly abused as a child when she's 9, 10 years old. And don't forget, she's pregnant when she's sitting on the witness stand. This evidence inflamed the passion of the members, and especially in conjunction with the improper trial counsel argument, which we discuss at length in Issue 3. And on top of that, the military judge's bias, which I'd like to segue, unless there's more questions on 412, I'd like to talk about the instruction issue. The defense counsel's argument was fair and it was proper, and the military judge erred when she told the members that he was wrong. That's just the bottom line. The government has a burden of proof. If there's holes in the government's case, it's the defense counsel's job, it's his duty to point those out to the members and say that the government didn't prove its case, so that they have a reasonable doubt. The military judge abandoned her neutral and impartial role when she let the trial counsel go completely off the reservation without any interruption during his closing argument. And I will concede that defense counsel should have objected. They didn't. But nonetheless, the military judge had a sua sponte duty to interrupt the personal attacks on Major Voorhees, the personal attacks on his counsel, and she didn't.
I'm sorry, what issue are you arguing? Well, arguing whether or not the military judge erred in providing the instruction, or are you arguing that this was an improper argument by trial counsel?
But they're related, Your Honor. The improper argument that's discussed in Issue 3 by trial counsel is related to Issue 4 because the military judge did not sua sponte interrupt the trial counsel, or when he finished, she didn't tell the members. The argument you just heard was really improper. He's not allowed to attack the accused. He's not allowed to attack the defense counsel. He's not allowed to give his personal opinion. She didn't do that. She let him go. But when the defense counsel makes an argument that she doesn't like, even though, in our opinion, it was perfectly fair, legitimate, and lawful, she says, the argument you heard is not in compliance with my instructions. And so she's telling the members, the defense counsel doesn't know the law, he doesn't know what he's doing, but she sanctioned the trial counsel's improper argument. And what it did is it gave him a green light to keep going, which he did, because the first sentence right out of the gate on his rebuttal was, I don't leave my family 250 days a year to sell you a story. I'm not in the business of convicting innocent people, and the defense counsel's a liar. So now they've heard it from the judge saying defense counsel is ignorant because he doesn't know the law, and the trial counsel is calling him a liar, and the judge doesn't correct that. She doesn't tell the members that that's improper, so she's biased, and it prejudiced Major Voorhees.
Counsel, let me redirect you to the actual instruction that, at least as to this issue, that you are asserting is error. Effectively, it's you may not assume that the government's failure to present evidence must have been detrimental to its case. My question for you, is that a correct statement of the law, or is your concern that when and how it said, when it was said, and the decision to make that correct statement of the law had some prejudicial impact on your client?
Both, Your Honor. I think that the timing of it showed her bias and prejudice. But I also think the content was wrong. And here's why. First of all, Mr. Waddington did not say that the members must presume that the evidence would have been harmful to the government. What he said is, wouldn't you have liked to have heard from these witnesses who had relevant information based on the government's evidence that they did put in? He didn't say you have to presume. He did say you can. It would have. It, don't you know that if had it been helpful to the government, they would have called those folks? And that argument is made in courtrooms around the country every day. When the government has witnesses such as OSI agents and the husband of the complaining witness, of course that it's fair to point out that the government chose not to call those witnesses. So the judge mischaracterized what the defense counsel's argument actually was. So in that respect, it was wrong, content-wise, on top of the fact that the timing of it was terribly prejudicial.
Doesn't Robert tell us that it's a possible inference that it could have harmed, and isn't that exactly what this instruction says?
Roberts does say that under normal circumstances, one may infer that it would be harmful to the other party who didn't call the witness. But I think that's a stronger statement. It's a correct statement, but I don't think that the defense counsel's argument even went that far. I think that the judge assumed that's what he was saying, and I know they didn't have the court reporter's transcript right there to look at it again, and I think she spoke in the heat of the moment. You can tell she spoke in the heat of the moment because in the 39A session where they I see that my time is gone. May I finish this sentence? Or?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. In the 39A session where the defense counsel objects to the instruction and he asks the judge, what's your authority? What's your basis? Because I don't think that was the correct instruction. She says, oh, well, I didn't pick on you. I was referring to both counsel, which clearly she wasn't. You can look at the actual instruction says that you can't presume that evidence the government didn't put in. She doesn't say evidence that a party didn't put in. So it's clearly directed, not to mention the fact that defense rested. So there wasn't evidence put on by the accused. And finally, and most tellingly, the trial counsel argues in his rebuttal, I'm really glad the military judge told you that the defense counsel doesn't know what he's doing. And she doesn't correct him. If that's not what she meant when the trial counsel said that, she should have stepped in and said, hold on, I was talking to both of you. And then finally, in the 39A, it's very clear she was talking to the defense counsel. So the timing of it and the content of it were just wrong. And I think she spoke out of just kind of a knee-jerk reaction and chose not to take corrective action when it was called to her attention. And I will reserve the rest of my time unless there's more questions.
Thank you. Government, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Tyler Musselman. Myself, along with Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this proceeding. First, evidence of the victim's previous sexual molestation was relevant to explaining her actions during the charged assault, and its admission was not barred by MRE 412 or MRE 403. Therefore, the military judge did not err when she had ruled that this evidence was admissible at trial. Alternatively, appellant lacks standing to object under Military Rule of Evidence 412 to admission of this evidence. In further alternative, even if appellant can demonstrate standing and that the military judge's admission of this evidence was error, he cannot demonstrate prejudice because he cannot show what substantial right of his was impacted by her ruling, much less show material prejudice. Now, in regards to the second issue before this court today, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in giving that instruction to the members. Her instruction followed the law, and it was appropriate under the circumstances of the case. Now, when looking at Issue 1, it's important to consider the context of 412. It's something that we see our Superior Court do over and over again when they are addressing issues and interpreting 412. 412 exists to protect victims. In the drafter's analysis, it describes it somewhat as a privilege, although not an absolute one. That sentence is echoed in Gaddis. The The rule is intended to shield victims of sex assault from embarrassing and degrading cross-examination. It's to safeguard alleged victims against the invasion of privacy and potential embarrassment that is associated with public disclosure of intimate sexual details. By affording victims protection in most instances, the rule encourages victims of sex assault to institute and participate in legal proceedings. As the court said in Banker Caff, the 1998 amendments especially were to transition this to a rule that provides for the participation and protection of victims. For example, in LRM, Caff itself found and really affirmed this idea that victims themselves have standing in MRE 412 discussions to participate both to provide arguments and facts.
Government, where in the rule does it say that MRE 412 is a privilege of the victim or protects a right of the victim? I think what you just read to us was the analysis. Is there anything in where it's included in the rules of evidence or anywhere else that would suggest that we're talking about a privilege here or a right?
Well, Your Honor, one of the things, obviously, noticing that 412 is not in a chapter entitled Privileges was 500 series. But when you look at 501, it talks about privileges, and it says contained within this manual. It does not restrict itself to Chapter 5. When you look at other privileges, for example, and I think it's MRE 305, the privilege against self-incrimination, that is not encompassed in Chapter 5, but still one would consider that, and it does contain the word privilege in that. So I don't think that we should be restricted to Chapter 500 when we're discussing privileges. Now, I would acknowledge in the language of itself, you will not see that word. However, it's alluded to in the drafter's analysis. CAF identified and quoted that passage in Gaddis.
And would you also acknowledge that when we talk in terms of privileges, that the rule includes waiver, when, under what circumstance it would be waived and applied, and that there's not similar language in MRE 412?
Well, I think if you look at, for example, MRE 513, it talks about the ability to claim a privilege, but it doesn't have anything in it about waiver. So I think when we're discussing this, it's definitely privilege-like, and you have circumstances, and I think that is important. And when we get to the facts of this case, when I'm talking about context here, this is government-offered evidence that the victim consented to. And so we look at the context, the rule designed to protect victims. The victim here consented to the admissibility of this, and it was offered by the government. That's important when you look at whether or not the rule applies. And I think here the drafter's analysis is illuminating. In both the 1998 amendment, the drafter's analysis, which is quoted in Banker when CAF is interpreting the rule, you have it echoed again in 2007. This idea that 412 applies when the evidence against whom it is offered can be described as an alleged victim of sexual misconduct. You'll see the case the United States cited Cosby and how the Navy Marine Corps utilized that language. If the evidence is offered against the appellant and not against the victim, then MRE 412 does not apply. That does not in any way, shape, or form contradict with the plain language of the rule. It contradicts with no binding precedent. It actually makes sense. It gets a result that you can grab onto. Senior Judge Brown, you asked a question about age-inappropriate sexual knowledge of minors, something that's introduced in, I would fair to say, at least a courtroom in the United States every day. How does that evidence come in? How do you rationalize that evidence coming in? If a person in daycare turns the corner and sees one of their five-year-olds engaging in some sort of sexual act by themselves, that could be considered 412. Well, other sexual conduct that's not charged. So how does it come in? There's a way to explain that. If it's offered at trial, it's not offered against the victim minor. It's offered against the appellant or the accused in that case. So you get this idea of what the rule actually exists to do, protect victims. Here the victim said, I want this evidence in. It's offered by the government. It's offered against the accused. That's how you can make sense of all this, is that language in the drafter's analysis. As far as the rule itself, that explanation appears twice. So it shows you the drafters themselves thought that the rule needed further explanation, and they provided for it twice, against whom the evidence is offered.
Counsel, where's the ambiguity in the rule that allows us to get to the drafter's analysis?
Alleged victim. And so not once but twice the drafters saw fit to declarify and define that term in the drafter's analysis. What does alleged victim mean? Does it mean alleged victim of larceny? Does it mean maybe a victim that's not charged but another victim? I think it's fair to say that in Both 1998 and the 2000 amendments, which were substantial amendments to the rule, the drafters saw fit to explain and define that term further. Also, I don't think you can, so you can get to, if statutory rules is either ambiguous or absurd result, but CAF themselves has relied on the drafters' analysis of 412 over and over and over again.
Counsel, let me just slow down your argument a little bit here. So it's the government's position that in MRE 412, when it says evidence offered to prove that any alleged victim engaged in other sexual behavior, when it says alleged victim, that's not a way to describe a victim in that particular case, that charged case, that's somehow is a more, you're reading it in a much more limited way?
No, I think that there's further explanation that needs to be given that term, and that's why when you see, for example, in the draft analysis in 1998, they talk about the term alleged victim in quotes, and that's how they're explaining it. And so it's sort of engaged in alleged victim, that's how you can get there. But I really don't think you need to stick to these defined terms of statutory interpretation in this case, because CAF themselves have quoted that passage when interpreting 412. Our Superior Court has already determined it necessary to look at that language over and over and over again, especially in the drafter's analysis of this rule, to determine the intent and the confines of this rule.
All right, so let me ask you this. To the extent that the rule, as written, and just go with me on this, I think you probably would not agree with this, but to the extent that the rule as written does not accurately achieve the purposes of the rule, to protect the victim or whatever the case may be, what should this court do? Is it our job or is it the president's job to fix the rule or to change the rule so that it reads and it acts in a way that was intended?
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is that you're not bound to the plain language of the rule. The CAF has said, and superior courts have said, the Supreme Court has said, the plain language of the rule controls unless it's either ambiguous and not clear or it results in an absurd result.
All right, so you believe this would be an absurd result in this case? Is that what you're hanging your hat on, or are you hanging your hat on this ambiguity of an alleged victim?
Both.
Okay.
And absurd result is obviously this idea that an accused or an appellant can utilize a rule designed to shield rape victims as a sword against the victim and the government. And so that's why when you look to the drafter's analysis, the language explains it to be strictly bound to the plain language. It's not a clear rule when you look at cases like Gaddis and Banker, and you see CAF continually referring to the drafter's analysis as part of the intent behind the rules and the clauses within it. And so utilizing the language of the drafter's analysis like the Navy Marine Court did in Cosby, here, the evidence was not offered against the accused. The evidence was offered against the appellant, not the victim, with the victim's consent by the government. And so, therefore, the military judge did not err when she found that military rule of evidence 412 does not apply to the evidence. Now, before getting into relevancy, I'd like to discuss the government's alternative arguments. First, that appellant lacks standing to object under military rule of evidence 412. One of the reasons I talked about the intent and the ideas behind this rule is because it comes into play with standing as well. In a supplemental cite, the United States cited Jones and Johnson. In those cases, CAF explored whether or not appellants have standing to raise objections based on the rights of third parties. In Johnson, you have, in those cases, you have one is an illegal subpoena by German authorities for an Article 32 witness. There, the court said that the subpoena rights are a third party. Appellant doesn't have standing to now object at trial to that evidence being used in trial. Then they went on and evaluated that further. For example, he may not have standing to enforce third party rights, but he would have standing if this impacted the reliability of the evidence or interfered with his rights of cross-examination or interfered with his rights to present evidence. And that was in Johnson. In Jones, you have Fifth Amendment Article 31 rights of third parties, personal to them, no standing to object to. In that case, the allegation was an SJA violated their rights, coerced them to waive their rights. And then once again, the court looked, did this interfere with the ability to cross-examine, to present evidence, etc., and ultimately found no standing. We have an analogous situation here. The military judge's ruling on government-presented evidence to which the victim did not consent, did not implicate any rights of appellant. At that point, it was strictly her privacy rights that were at play. This didn't impact constitutional rights of cross-examination. It didn't impact his right to present a defense, potentially maybe consent or present evidence of that or present evidence of other sources of injury. So what you have is it's strictly narrowed to the unique facts and circumstances of this case, which I can't emphasize enough, that it was only the victim's rights at play. So if the idea behind the rule is that the government, under these circumstances, there was no admissibility under 412 barred admission, the only person that was impacted was the victim. And so you look, did it result in unreliable evidence? No. In fact, the defense was willing to offer this evidence before trial, as shown by their 412 motion. Did it impact his ability to cross-examine? There's no allegation of that. He was able to cross-examine the victim. Did the ruling somehow limit his ability to present evidence? There's no allegation of that, and absolutely not. So like Jones and Johnson, there's no standing here to object under 412 to this evidence. Now, similarly, the same rationale can be used when viewing whether or not there's prejudice. Under Article 59, prejudice, it has to be materially prejudice of substantial right. The question is, what right of appellant was at all impacted by the military judge's decision? There isn't one. So what you have is, you have the same situation with the unlawful subpoena. What right did he have in regards to the unlawful subpoena? He didn't have one. So if appellant cannot point to a substantial right that was actually impacted by the ruling, there can be no showing of prejudice. And you see that why that's intertwined within the discussion of Jones and Johnson when they talk about the reliability of evidence and everything else. So whether you use that rationale to find he has no standing or can't show prejudice because he has no right that was impacted, then it comes to the same conclusion.
All right, let me ask you a couple of questions about that. So if we find that the admission of this testimony about the victim's childhood abuse was error, in other words, that he has standing, to put it in your way, as well as the rule should have been applied such that the military judge should not have allowed this testimony. All right, so explain again to me why the introduction of erroneous evidence that apparently was very critical for the government, and they argued about how critical it was for purposes of consent, how he was not prejudiced by that, i.e., he was convicted.
Yes, sir.
I mean, isn't that kind of critical when it comes to prejudice? Is that if that evidence was so valuable that the government relied on it extensively in their argument and otherwise to convict him, it seems like that's pretty critical as to whether or not he was prejudiced. No?
Not if there can't first be a substantial right identified. And so that's why Jones and Johnson are important. There were errors by the government and a legal subpoena. However, the evidence came in at trial and was used to convict the appellant. But the court still found no standing. For example, and I'll point to MRE 412. Within MRE 412, you do have some rights identified for an accused, right? If the evidence is constitutionally required, or if he needs to present the evidence to show another source of injury. Those all relate to the sort of rights that are identified in Jones and Johnson. Here there was no interference with his right of cross-examination. There was nothing prohibited him from presenting evidence. So the question is, just a violation of the MRE itself is not a substantial right. The government's been able to find no cases that say a substantial right for the accused is that the military judge is required to abide by the MRE.
Is it a substantial right of the accused that the government proves their case beyond reasonable doubt?
Yes.
All right. And in determining whether or not the government has proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt, don't we have to look at properly admissible evidence?
You look at the evidence that was admitted at trial.
And if some of that evidence was improperly admitted, isn't that where we should focus our question as to whether or not the error, i.e. allowing this evidence in, prejudiced the appellant, i.e. The members had this critical piece of evidence that they used to find the accused guilty beyond reasonable doubt.
Not before you identify the substantial right. And that's why it was important for the government to cite Jones and Johnson. In Article 32 testimony specifically, there was an error by the government in that case. The judge found that the subpoena was illegal. That evidence was still brought into trial and still used to convict the appellant. However, there was no prejudice there. And so here it's not, if we say that every error, for example, of a military judge to fail to follow the MRE is a due process violation, if that's what we're ultimately going to get to, then every error would be a constitutional error. And we know that not to be the case. So what substantial right? Is it the right to present evidence? No, he's presented whatever evidence he needed to. The right to effectively cross-examine. Cross-examination wasn't limited in any way. That's the idea behind prejudice, is there is a step there first that you have to get to. And you can see those rights elsewhere in 412. But in this unique case, the only person that was impacted by the judge's decision as far as their rights went was the victim. And so that's why here the appellant can't show that a substantial right was impacted in any way. So whether this court utilizes the drafter's analysis, finds a lack of standing, or a lack of prejudice, doesn't all those come to no relief for appellant. Here the drafter's analysis states it has to be offered against an alleged victim. It wasn't here. For standing purposes, and once again, these are all for the unique facts of this case. Now, obviously, an appellant has standing, for example, if a military judge keeps evidence out. That impacted his ability to present evidence. Or if a military judge didn't allow the appellant to cross-examine the alleged victim on a previous sexual encounter, well, that limits cross-examination. Those are all rights that are identified. But if that's not impacted and all we have left are the rights of the victim, which is what 412 is meant for, then there's no standing there for him to enforce the rights of a third party. Now, taking all of that into account, either the military judge did not err by admitting the evidence for holding that 412 didn't apply. As far as the relevance goes, the evidence was, it was what was going through her head at the time of assault. This is no different than asking a victim on the stand, why didn't you get up? Why did you freeze? Well, I was afraid. He pushed me down. He blocked the door. Thoughts in their head that explain why they didn't cry out, why they didn't scream. You can look no further than appellant's brief on issue one, factual and legal sufficiency, when they discuss the lack of crying out, the lack of response, the lack of this. This evidence goes to explain all of that, and that's what the military judge found. Now, as far as appellant's knowledge goes, knowledge doesn't make this evidence, or lack thereof, irrelevant. Careful review of the record will reveal that the government did have evidence that he knew or was aware, or at least they could have alluded to it. During motion argument on this issue, it was clear that defense counsel did not want his client's knowledge of the assault coming in. On page 73, you see that in the facts section. You'll when he talks about there's a danger of unfair prejudice when there's nothing to back that up. Then there's a discussion about how is the door going to be open to this later. The senior trial counsel talks about how certain questioning may open the door for the government to get in appellant's knowledge of this, and the defense counsel says we won't open that door. There's a clear, throughout the language used, it's clear the defense counsel is objecting to knowledge. So to sit here and say that that's now an error by the judge, something that clearly was in the defense counsel's favor and he fought for through the motions hearing, is either waived or butted up against by, or caged off by the idea of invited error. And so as far as that portion of the error goes, this court should not hear those claims. Relevancy was already stated, as a military judge found. Balancing test was done, which is given discretion. It's a 403, abuse of discretion. So it's not so much to disagree with the judge. Something has to be shown more than that. And under the facts of this case.
Counsel, the trial judge found that Emory 412 didn't apply to this case because the sexual behavior, or didn't meet the definition, the sexual abuse didn't meet the definition of sexual behavior, and that she was focused on, I think, the voluntariness or consensual or non-consensual nature of that. So my question is, do you think the judge got that right? Because she didn't cite as her basis for her ruling and not finding that Forkel applied based on a lack of standing by the appellant or because of looking at who the evidence was offered against.
Your Honor, I would say that the judge's determination that 412 does not apply to non-consensual sexual acts is contradicted by binding precedent from CAF. And those cases were cited by the United States in their brief, specifically Velez, Rogers, Buenaventura, Berger, and Pagel. Not all of those are binding. Some of those are unreported. There's an Air Force case and a Navy Marine case sprinkled in there as well. But in those cases, what you see are defense offered non-consensual sexual, behavior, if you want to call that, of the alleged victim, offered by the defense, analyzed under 412, or at least in a 412 framework. Now, what this court should consider is whether or not, in the case of government-offered evidence where the victim consents, does non-consensual sexual acts, is there a difference there? But I will tell you that that seems to be contradicted. If that finding was erroneous, what you ultimately have then is the judge used the wrong legal analysis to come to the right conclusion, and so her ultimate decision is not error. Now, if there's no other questions on the...
Sorry, counsel. Were you saying that had she used 412, she still would have not admitted this evidence? Is that what you were just...
No, Your Honor. What I was saying is even if this court finds that 412 applies to non-consensual acts committed against a victim, then the judge's rationale would have been erroneous. But she still gets to the correct conclusion of 412 doesn't apply. And that relates to the government's argument regarding who the evidence was offered against. If there's no further questions from the court on the 412 issue, we'll move on to the second issue.
Go ahead.
The military judges, as this court pointed out, the military judges' instruction told the members that there's no requirement that they must presume that it's detrimental to the government, giving some leeway for them to decide that anyway. Even if it was a you will not presume evidence not offered was detrimental to the government, that's still a proper instruction, given the litany of cases cited by the government and what in the missing witness factors. Also, you have, when you look at her instruction as a whole, the very last thing she did in that section was remind them of their burden and emphasize that the government has the burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt. As far as any impartiality concerns, it wasn't heavily briefed by the parties. There was a case that we cited for a different purpose, I think a standard review, Quintanilla, which has, that case talks about impartiality. There's a strong presumption that the judge is impartial, and a party seeking to demonstrate bias must overcome a high burden, particularly when alleged bias involves actions taken in conjunction with judicial proceedings. When you look at this, neutral instructions, given correct instructions after argument of both parties, purposely kept it neutral, no need to clarify. You have the litany of other instructions, including the one that says, if at any point I do anything that makes you think I favor one side or the other, that's not accurate. You also have the failure of defense to challenge her at trial or raise a mistrial, so there is a waiver argument there. That if there really was some impartiality, why wasn't she challenged right then when she denied the defense's request for further instructions? In this case, there's been no showing that the defense put these OSI agents, the other people that saw the victim drinking, the victim's husband on a witness list, and it was denied. There was no motion under Article 46 to sequester their testimony to have the judge issue a ruling having them there. So, and it boils down to, did the judge abuse her discretion? And if those are things that a judge is supposed to consider when determining whether or not to give this instruction, the answer is absolutely not. She didn't have any of those things in front of her. There is no evidence of whether or not these other witnesses that were discussed in defense counsel's closing argument were biased in any sort of way. The reality is when our Superior Court cites to Graves, and they really hang their hat on, was the person available to both sides? I think it's in Taylor, they just presume that an OSI agent is available to both sides, and that's it. So here, the OSI agent, bring him in. And but for those, any evidence of that, the judge did not abuse her discretion in saying, in limiting any inferences. I think in Hold, the instructions, the conduct of the judge leads those actions. There's no abuse of discretion there. And that's a higher standard, especially when we consider how much deference a judge is given in non-mandatory instructions. Now, barring any further questions from the court, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Appellant's claim for relief relating to military judge's admission of the victim's prior sexual molestation used to explain her conduct during the charged offense, it fails. This evidence was relevant. The judge did not abuse her discretion in finding so or in conducting a 403 balancing test. This evidence was not barred by MRE 412 or 403. Alternatively, appellant lacks standing to raise an objection under 412. And further alternative, even if he has standing, he cannot show prejudice because he cannot show what substantial right of his was actually implicated in the judge's ruling. Regarding the second issue before this court today, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in instructing the members as she did. Her instructor followed the law relating to missing witness and missing evidence inferences and was appropriate under the circumstances. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with the last thing first. Let's talk about standing. First of all, the government did not object to the MRE 412 litigation at trial on the basis that Major Voorhees didn't have standing. That argument is waived. They are stopped from raising it on appeal. They didn't argue it below. They can't argue it here. Secondly, the cases that they cite, Jones and Johnson and the others, have nothing to do with MRE 412. And we agree with the court that MRE 412 is not a privilege, and it is a rule of relevancy. Again, the president could have written the rule to make it a privilege. He could have made it more analogous to 513, and he did not. Again, if the government wants to petition the president to change the rule, they're free to do that, but we have to apply the rule as it exists today at the time of trial. And again, I'm not trying to be smart aleck, but frankly, the CAF decisions outrank the drafter's analysis. So the drafter's analysis can say whatever it wants, but when CAF speaks on a specific issue, that takes priority. And yes, CAF has referred to the drafter's analysis in some of its opinions, but not on this issue. They haven't said when the government wants to put evidence in that the defense objects to, the drafter's analysis saves them. The CAF has not spoken on that. When they have referred to the drafter's analysis, it's on some different issue. So we can't assume that the drafter's analysis overturns Banker and Gaddis in those cases. And one possible explanation for why the government's allowed to put some of this evidence on in other cases may be that the defense just doesn't think to object to it on 412 grounds. I mean, we're speculating here, but maybe it's not ripe. It hasn't been decided by an appellate court because the defense hasn't raised that issue like the defense did in this case. So Major Voorhees shouldn't be prejudiced because other defense counsel don't have the foresight to make the proper objection. So I find it interesting that the government wants to keep talking about the Navy case from 2004, the Cosby case. And it's important, I think, to understand the chronology of the case law. So you have Banker from CAF, it's decided on 23 August of 2004, saying that the rule applies to both parties, and if it doesn't fall within an exception, it doesn't come in. And then you have the Cosby case from the Navy Court 3 days later on 26 August 2004. Now, I know that in today's world, everybody's on the computer, and we know these CAF decisions come out instantaneously, but I don't think we did 12 years ago. And so I can't explain why the Navy Court came out the way it did on Cosby, but they're wrong. And it wasn't the main issue in the case anyway, by the way. But the government ignores a case from the same Navy Court 2 years later, 2006, where they corrected their course, right? They went off course with Cosby. They corrected their course in Meredith. In Meredith, the government tried to put evidence on that the complaining witness wouldn't have consented to the accused's sexual advances because she had rejected similar advances earlier in the evening. Sexual predisposition evidence covered by 412. The Navy Court said, it doesn't fall within an enumerated exception. I realize that the government wants to put it in because it helps their case, but it doesn't come in because it's not admissible under 412. So Cosby's kind of an outlier, but it is an outlier. It's overruled, if you will, by operation, by the same court in 2006 saying, no, even if the government wants to put it in, it still has to fit within the rules language. So let's talk about substantial right for a moment. certainly Major Voorhees has a substantial right in a due process, fundamental right to a fair trial, to be convicted only upon the government presenting competent evidence and proving to the members beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty. If that's not a substantial right, I don't know what is. If the court would like further briefing on that issue, certainly we'd be happy to accommodate. But I just can't believe that they're not saying that his right to a fair trial and to due process is not a substantial right. We think it is. Jones and Johnson, those are not 412 cases. The fact in LRM versus Kassenberg, it's a 412 case of sorts. But the fact that the complaining witness has standing and can be heard is completely separate question from whether the accused has standing. Accused has standing in his own court-martial here. So I don't think that the supplemental cases that the government cites are on point. Knowledge. Thank you. The members did not hear evidence that Major Voorhees knew. And I can tell you from reading the record, that would have been a hotly contested issue. And I take issue respectfully with the government's characterization of the defense counsel's argument that begins actually on page 68 of the record. If you read 68 all the way through to 73 or 74 or 77 maybe, what the defense counsel's saying is right on target. He's saying, look, if you're going to let the government put in evidence that this girl, this complaining witness, was saying no in her head, but not communicating that in any way to the accused, then, and you're not going to let the evidence of whether he knew about it come in, then any person that has sex with this woman for the rest of her life is committing a rape. That doesn't make any sense, Judge. I think that's my interpretation of what the defense counsel's arguing. I don't agree that he's objecting to introduction of knowledge. I think he's saying you have to have knowledge, because without knowledge, everybody's raping her, every sexual partner she ever has for the rest of her life, because all she has to do is come in and say, well, I was thinking about that abuse when I was 10. I didn't consent. Now you've got a rapist. And that doesn't make any sense. And so I ask the court to review the record and see which side you agree with. So moving on to the instruction. It's important to acknowledge the timing of this, Your Honor. If she thought that the defense counsel's argument was improper, she could have interrupted him and said, that's not the law, counsel, and he would have had an opportunity to correct. He didn't say that the members must presume the evidence would be harmful. By the way, there's a distinction, I think, a logical distinction between something being not helpful to the government and something being harmful. I don't think they're equivalent. Something could be not helpful because it doesn't help either party. It doesn't mean it's harmful to the government. And all he said was, don't you think if it would have been helpful to the government, they would have brought him here? He didn't tell the members you have to presume it would have harmed the government's case, but that's what the judge instructed the members. Well, he just told you that, and you can't presume that. I mean, my point is, again, it's connected to the bias and the timing. He had already finished his argument by the time she decided to sua sponte, interject herself. If she had done that in a more timely fashion, he could have said, okay, you know, the judge is right. You mustn't presume that, but you may. He could have turned the must into a may if he didn't even said it, which I couldn't find in the record that he said you must. But even if he had, she should have corrected him, and then he could have corrected his course. He, by the time she decided to reprimand him from the members, he was finished. And yes, should he have objected to the trial counsel's argument? Should he have objected immediately to the instruction? Yes, but this is plain error. I mean, all of the trial counsel's improper argument went without objection, and it was clearly inappropriate, and our contention is that it was all plain error. The government wants to talk to you about, well, there's no evidence of what the discovery requests are, witness requests. That's not in the record, and it's not a proper consideration for this court. What this court needs to look at is the record. What did the parties say? What did the parties do that's contained in the record of trial? And the point is, the government had unique access, and I've cited in my supplemental authorities that law enforcement is uniquely identified with the prosecution. OSI is the government. They're all big G, okay? OSI is the government. OSI does data dumps of cell phones every day of the week. We all know that. And that's all that the defense counsel said was, don't you know that, and text messages were an issue in this case, because she testified that as she was having all this sex with Major Voorhees, she felt like she was cheating. When she reported it to her husband, she didn't say, hey, guess what, I was raped. She said, I cheated on you. And it was he who said, weren't you raped? But she testified that she texted Major Voorhees on the night in question, and she deleted those text messages because she didn't want her husband to find them and know she had cheated. So those text messages were a big deal. If those text messages said something helpful to the government had peculiar access to OSI. You know that if the trial counsel wants a witness interviewed or a document produced, all they have to do is pick up the phone and call OSI. It doesn't work like that for the defense. Thank you. So This being available to both sides is...
Counsel, does the defense at the trial level have the ability to file a motion to compel a witness, that even if that witness happened to be an OSI agent or a government actor?
Yes, sir. So
that would be a method that a trial defense counsel could effectively compel that witness in testimony.
And again, if I had been the trial lawyer, I might have done things differently, but I wasn't. And so we're stuck with what we've got. And the record as it exists is that the government had access to OSI. If the evidence had been helpful to the government, it's a reasonable inference from the evidence that was admitted that the government could have called them. All the defense counsel was doing is poking holes in the government's case in order to show the members why they should have a reasonable doubt. He wasn't asking them to presume or assume anything. He was just saying, where are these people? If they would have said something helpful to the government, you would have heard from them. And that's a perfectly legitimate argument. And she made up this, she just made up this instruction. The defense counsel asked her, where does this come from? She had no idea. It's not in the bench book. And there's not a case that I could find. So the instruction was erroneous in how it was administered, when it was administered, and the content of it. And Major Voorhees' substantial right to a fair trial was implicated. And when you combine all of these things together, the factual insufficiency, the improper argument, the judge's biased and improper instruction, the erroneous introduction of the terribly inflammatory and prejudicial evidence that the poor woman was sexually abused for a year every night by someone taking care of her, all of that combined to deprive Major Voorhees of a fair trial, we ask the court to please set aside the findings and the sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.